I have been asked to do the introduction for today's moderator, Judge Amal Thapar. I'm very honored to do it, but I have to tell you, Judge, that to pull the biographical information, I was in a real rush, so I just used the first link that came up when I Googled you, and that was a podcast you did with the University of Louisville about your love for classic rock. So the biographical details I have are that one of the formative experiences of your life was seeing the Cannons come out when AC/DC did for Those About to Rock. That if you were stranded on a desert island, you would take with you albums from The Who, The Doors, and Rush. That the musician you would most like to have dinner with is Jim Morrison. And that your childhood was marked by endless debates about whether or not Led Zeppelin was in fact the greatest rock band of all time. All of that is true, by the way. I'm not just joking around. It's an incredible podcast. You should listen to it. But of course, everybody knows I'm teasing. The real reason that we've invited Judge Thapar to do this today is that he is one of the most accomplished legal minds in the United States. He is a judge on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. He has also been a federal district court judge. He served as a U.S. attorney. He's written an outstanding gem of a book called The People's Justice, which is about the jurisprudence of Clarence Thomas. He's a graduate of Boston College and of the University of California at Berkeley Law School. On behalf of the Federal Society, I am pleased to welcome him to this stage.
Thank you very much. So, Caroline gave me one instruction, and she said to do it at the end, but I'm not good at following instructions because I'm a judge, so I'm going to do it at the beginning because I don't want to forget and have Caroline sanction me. So I've been asked to announce, this is important, a location change for this evening's lecture and reception, which I hope you all will go to. The 4:30 Robert Bork Lecture has been moved to the International Ballroom, and the reception that follows will be on the ballroom's terrace level. I will try to remember to announce that again at the end so you all don't forget, but I'm counting on you all to remember. Okay, now on to the show. It's a real treat to be here. We are so grateful to the Federalist Society to let us talk about the Second Amendment. I think this panel is truly amazing. I had the privilege of meeting with them ahead of time and talking to them ahead of time, and I can tell you, they have a lot to say. So I am going to be very quick on the bios. They are online. These are three of the greatest speakers you're ever going to hear on the Second Amendment. So you're lucky to be here. That's what I'll tell you. And I'm going to give you one or two fun facts about each of them. But the rest of their amazing bios you can find online. So first speaking is going to be Professor Merkel, who is a professor at Charleston School of Law. Two really cool things about him, other than what he's got really interesting things to say that I may disagree with, but I'm really interested to hear. And some things I agree with, including that he's not going to get to, unfortunately, including the problems with the tiers of scrutiny. But the first thing is he's an author of The Militia and the Right to Arms, or How the Second Amendment Fell Silent. It is a book he authored with the late Richard, is it Uviller? How do you pronounce it?
Uviller.
Uviller. And then the other thing is, in 2013, only 11 years ago, he successfully defended his dissertation called The Second Amendment and the Constitutional Right to Self-Defense. And I'd like to have an entire discussion just about that, but he will get to bits and pieces, but not really that in particular. Moving to his left is Professor Mark Smith. The cool thing about Mark Smith is Mark is the host of the popular Four Boxes Diner Second Amendment YouTube channel, which I encourage you to watch, especially an episode in 2023 where I appeared to talk about my book, The People's Justice. Mark was kind enough to let me come on. He invited me to come on, and he was kind enough to have me. Probably the worst episode in his career, he would say, but still, nonetheless, he put up with a federal judge talking about a book. Of course, I had the McDonald chapter in The People's Justice, which Mark liked, I think. Finally, he also wrote a book called Disarmed, What the Ukraine War Teaches Americans About the Right to Bear Arms, and he wrote a book called First They Came for the Gun Owners. So I'm giving you a list of books here that you all should go read. If you, it's your after reading this panel. And last but not least is my good friend David Thompson. He's the managing partner at Cooper & Kirk. And amongst, he does a ton of constitutional litigation. As we all know, the law firm does a lot of important litigation across the country, including election-related litigation. But get this, he's currently litigating, now listen to this number, 60 Second Amendment cases. 6-0. I would venture to guess, without any scientific knowledge, that is the most any law firm is doing in the country. So thank you all for being here. It is a real treat. Because they have so much valuable stuff to say, they're going to go. I actually, something I never do, I gave them each 15 minutes. They've timed themselves because I told them how harsh I was going to be. And a few of them have asked for grace for 16 minutes. So I'm going to give that to them. So with that introduction, Professor Merkel, the floor is yours.
Good morning. I should say that even though I'm a Second Amendment skeptic, I'm not necessarily a right to self-defense skeptic. I would anchor that constitutional right in other provisions and other doctrinal areas, such as the Ninth Amendment or substantive due process or procedural due process. When it comes to the Second Amendment, I don't read the Second Amendment the same way a majority on the Supreme Court does and the same way my co-panelists do. So first and foremost, thanks to the Federalist Society, especially Mark Smith, who has invited me on three occasions. I was sick last year, or you would have heard from me last year as well. I welcome the opportunity to join you in conversation. As you may have surmised, my views are in a distinct minority among assembled company, but I truly appreciate the opportunity to air an opposing viewpoint. In any vibrant and vital constitutional culture, cross-party dialogue is absolutely essential. And along the way, minority views may, if expressed persuasively, even grow into majority views in an emerging new age. To take one example, Justice Thomas's critique of affirmative action has, after at least 40 years, left me doubting that I could defend affirmative action on policy grounds, even if it were still legally permissible. To take another salient example, after 90 years of critical engagement, you and your predecessors, those upon whose work you've built, have, it appears, finally convinced 50.0% of the population that the New Deal was wrongheaded. So, you know, congratulations, well played, my friends across the aisle. I don't have 90 years to convince you that Heller was wrongly decided. I have 15 minutes minus however much time I've already used up to engage Rahimi and originalism. So the Supreme Court's Rahimi decision this June took up a facial challenge to a federal statute prohibiting individuals subject to a domestic violence restraining order from possessing a firearm under the Second Amendment. The court held that the Second Amendment was not violated by the federal statute that prohibited individuals subject to domestic violence restraining order from being compelled to surrender their weapons. And to begin at the beginning, petitioner Zaki Rahimi is perhaps one of the least sympathetic rights claimants in Supreme Court history. So as Chief Justice Roberts observed in his opinion for eight justices in Rahimi, Zaki Rahimi is implicated in at least seven different criminal assaults involving a firearm, including shooting at his former girlfriend, who is the mother of their young child, threatening a different woman with a gun, shooting into the house of a man to whom Rahimi had sold narcotics because this individual apparently was talking trash about Rahimi, shooting at the other driver after a car accident, shooting at a trucker who flashed his lights, shooting in the air while driving through a residential neighborhood, and most recently shooting at the ceiling of a Whataburger restaurant after the establishment declined Rahimi's dining companion's credit card. suffice it to say that in a functional system of policing and prosecuting under law, one would expect governing constitutional norms to allow Rahimi's disarmament, and that's precisely what 8 of 9 justices determined in Rahimi, with Justice Thomas alone dissenting. Consider that under the famous United States versus Salerno decision of 1987, pretrial detention of a federal defendant is not only constitutionally permissible, but is routinely ordered where an individual is determined to pose danger to specific persons or to the general public. And if an individual can be deprived pre-trial of that most basic liberty of not being behind bars, of not being shackled, surely deprivation of the right to weapons possession must be constitutional as well. Of course, weapons deprivation involves not only more generalized considerations respecting liberty under the 5th or 14th Amendment, but also restraints on the more specific guarantee recognized in Heller in 2008, the guarantee of the right to private possession of weapons for purposes of lawful self-defense, wholly unconnected to militia service. Now, 2 years ago in 2022, in New York State Rifle versus Pistol Association versus Bruin, the Supreme Court moved beyond the rights recognition question at issue in Heller and in McDonald versus City of Chicago, which incorporated the Second Amendment right against the states through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, and took up the question of rights enforcement under the Second Amendment. Justice Thomas, writing for a 6-3 court in Bruin, held that the constitutionality of a restraint on the ability to possess weapons today depends on the ability of the government to show that the challenged restriction is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearms regulation. Now, this past June in Rahimi, 8 out of 9 justices determined that the challenged federal statute allowing disarmament of persons subject to a domestic violence restraining order was, in fact, consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation, over a vigorous dissent from Justice Thomas, who, of course, is the author of Bruin, the case that gives us the standard on which the Rahimi court purported to rely. Of course, according to Justice Thomas, Chief Justice Roberts only purported to rely on the Bruin standard, but did not do so in fact. So Chief Justice Roberts held that the government had clearly shown that the challenged restriction was consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearms regulation in that it was sufficiently analogous to 1, founding era surety laws, and 2, founding era going armed laws. And I suspect other members of the panel will go into these analogies in more detail. But what I'll briefly note at the moment is how close the analogy must be is, under Bruin, apparently the outcome determinative question. Chief Justice Roberts stressed that the constitutionally permissible gun law today need not be a genetic twin trapped in amber, preserved since the founding era, awaiting reanimation and reactivation today. Other justices and commentators have chosen different vocabulary, stating that today's law need be no doppelganger of a statute in force in 1791. Justice Thomas himself has used similar vocabulary. But in practice, as Justice Thomas's dissenting opinion in Rahimi makes abundantly clear, virtually any contemporary statute that can be distinguished from putative founding era analogs will fail to pass muster with Justice Thomas. In pursuing the, I think, more important analogy the analogy to so-called going armed laws, which appeared to inform the majority's decision to a far greater degree than the surety laws that figure very prominently in Justice Thomas's dissent, Chief Justice Roberts turned to the statute of Northampton. Now, happily, from my perspective, he laid greater weight on founding era analogs to the statute of Northampton. But I want to pause and reflect on how absurd it is to focus on the statute of Northampton in determining whether gun control measures are permissible today. We're talking about a statute passed by the English Parliament sitting in Northampton in 1328, at least a decade before firearms appeared in Western Europe. The principal focus of Parliament was to settle a treaty with Edinburgh, ending a war with Scotland. The statute is written in Latin. Those who cite it today invariably quote a translation from 1800 published in modern English in the statutes at large, 472 years after the statute was written. So if we're going to decide the constitutionality of gun control measures today based on their analogy or inanalogy to a statute enacted 696 years ago in another country by a parliament focused on a different question at a time when no member of parliament had ever seen a gun, our constitutionalism has truly reached what Justice Scalia once called a state of terminal silliness. Now, unfortunately, here is where you and I probably part company, because to my mind, when it comes to terminally silly constitutionalism, at least in the Second Amendment arena, no one has contributed more to the sad state of affairs than the late Justice Scalia himself. After all, he's the textualist who decided that the first 13 words of the 27-word Second Amendment have no legal effect today whatsoever. He's the originalist who ignores the surely salient fact that all 12 members of the House of Representatives who spoke on the pending Second Amendment in 1789 spoke of a militia-centered right, and that the principal topic of conversation recorded in the annals of Congress involving these 12 members who spoke was conscientious objection to the performance of mandatory militia duty. And Justice Scalia is the champion of original public meaning, who blissfully ignores the documentary record of 18th century North American usage, revealing that well over 95% of the time that the phrase bearing arms or its cognates appeared in books, pamphlets, newspapers, and government documents in the late colonial or early national periods, its meaning was unambiguously military and collective in character, not private and individualistic. So with Justice Scalia's death in 2016, Justice Thomas emerges, of course, as the most prominent originalist and the most enthusiastic supporter of the right to armed self-defense on the Supreme Court. He, of course, is also the lone dissenter in Rahimi, disagreeing with the eight other justices who concluded that Justice Thomas's Bruin standard allows the de-arming of Rahimi, and not just the de-arming of Rahimi. Rahimi mounted a facial challenge, so the decision upholds the statute allowing disarmament of anyone subject to a domestic violence restraining order. Now, according to Justice Thomas, the permissible gun regulations of today do not need to be an exact historical twin of those from the founding period, but it appears they must come very close. They must serve the same purpose as founding era regulations by means closely analogous thereto. And bear in mind that Justice Thomas is famously ready, willing, and able to distinguish just about any regulation that he does not like that is proffered as evidence of founding era practice permitting gun regulation. In Bruin, he justified invalidation of New York century-old Sullivan law by distinguishing dozens of regulations he did not like. To paraphrase Justice Breyer's dissent, Justice Thomas found some historical restraints on gun ownership or use too old, others were too new, some were too Western, some were too Eastern. Some were dubious because they applied in the federal territories, others were dubious because they applied in urban settings. Some were inapposite because they tracked the statute of Northampton, others because they departed from the statute of Northampton. Now, what Justice Thomas clearly would allow are sureties and criminal prosecution. But let's start with sureties. What good would it do Rahimi's ex-CM and her child AR for Rahimi to post a bond pledging good behavior? We know perfectly well his track record of impulsive, reckless violence, an unjustifiable and inexcusable discharge of deadly weapons. It's a fortunate thing that he appears to be a very bad shot. If he'd been a better shot, a half dozen people or more might be dead. And a forfeiture of a $1,000 bond would do them no good at all. Now, perhaps a better solution would be for CM, Rahimi's ex, to arm herself in anticipation of another Rahimi attack. But her right to do so remains undisputed. The question, after all, isn't whether CM can arm herself to defend herself against Rahimi. It's whether Rahimi may be stripped of his means of aggression pre-trial. Of course, Justice Thomas says, well, why not simply try him? And I would assume all reasonable people agree that Rahimi should be prosecuted, convicted, and confined by now. But these things take time. Ours is a violent age, and we are a violent people. The dockets are long. But under Salerno, there seems to be no question that Rahimi's track record justifies pretrial detention. And if pretrial detention is constitutionally permissible, why not pretrial disarmament? Perhaps Rahimi would rather be on the streets with no gun than behind bars with no gun. I leave you with this hypothetical inquiry. Consider this. Fast forward to 2029. The good people of America have repealed the 22nd Amendment. Was President Reagan's retirement project urging repeal of the 22nd Amendment so that a future president might, like FDR, seek a third term or a fourth term or perhaps even more? So imagine it's 2029 and this has happened and is authorized by federal statute passed in early 2029. President Obama orders state civil servants to go door to door and ask householders whether they have firearms in the home, if so, how many, and whether those weapons are compliant with federal law. So I ask you, is this outrageous infringement of our dearest liberties constitutionally permissible under the Second Amendment? Well, for any sincere originalist, I argue it would have to be, because the statute, the hypothetical statute I just described, mirrors the Militia Census Act of 1803. That act was signed into law by Thomas Jefferson, required reporting to state adjutants general, reporting by state adjutants general, state civil servants, to the Secretary of War. The act implemented policies originating in cabinet discussions with Jefferson's most trusted advisor, Secretary of State James Madison, principal author of the Second Amendment. Of course, for Justice Thomas, the Militia Census Act of 2029 would not be constitutionally permissible, but a cynic might wonder whether this unconstitutionality reflects results orientation rather than a commitment to founding era understanding. Now, if Justice Scalia was still living in 2029, he would not have found a Militia Census Act of 2029 constitutionally permissible either. It violates the anti-commandeering principle he invented in Prince versus United States in 1996. But of course, the federal gun law invalidated in Prince required precisely what the Militia Act of 1803, the Militia Census Act of 1803 required, which is that state civil servants enforce federal gun policy. There was no anti-commandeering doctrine in 1803. Had there been, Jefferson, the most states' rights-oriented president of them all, would not have signed the law, and James Madison, the author of the Second Amendment, would not have been on board with enforcement of the act either. So you're now going to hear from people whose views you may find more congenial, and then we will have further conversation.
Good morning. Today I'm going to talk about the framework that lower court judges must apply when they are applying the Heller-Bruin methodology of interpreting and applying to modern-day gun control laws the Second Amendment. Now, as we know, many lower courts, for those of you who watch my channel, The Four Boxes Diner, which has been viewed 43 million times today in the last couple years, you know that I do take criticism with many of the lower court judges who have perhaps gone awry in their approach and application of Second Amendment jurisprudence. But there do appear to be two particular areas where you see an inordinate number of mistakes by lower court judges. The first is what constitutes a suitable historical analog law in the first place. And the second is, how does one derive from those historical analog laws a principle that constitutes some sort of historical tradition of firearms regulation which lower court judges are supposed to find in the context of figuring out if there's an exception to the unqualified command of the text of the Second Amendment? And again, it's very important to start off with the text of the Second Amendment, not as sort of a administrative ministerial task, but it's because the U.S. Supreme Court has specifically said that the text of the Second Amendment is an unqualified command. Now, this is very important to understand. Why? Because when you read newspaper articles or you read comments that go along the lines of, like, I don't understand history. History is too hard for me. I'm not a historian. Guess what? If there is no historical tradition of regulation, if there is no history, there is one bit of history that is undeniably there, and that is the text of the Second Amendment itself that is literally in the Constitution, which is indeed the definitive historical law, the historical analog, if you will, of the views of the founders to how they viewed the right to keep and the right to bear arms. It's in the text itself. So anyone that says, I don't understand history, or we can't find history, the answer is, well, then if you can't find the history, read the text of the Second Amendment, apply, and rule against the government. Now, let's assume, though, that you're representing the government, and the government says, oh, yeah, we want to justify some modern-day gun control law. Okay, so how does the government go about doing it? And what can they do, what can they not do? To begin with, they are supposed to, of course, as we know from Heller and Bruin, and remember, Bruin is really just Heller with a paint-by-numbers approach. Heller and Bruin are the same methodology. The only difference is that Bruin spelled it out to try to get the lower court judges to follow the Heller methodology of look at the text first, and then shift the burden to the government to find some sort of historical analog exception to the text of the Second Amendment. But the government cannot engage in that approach to finding historical analog laws and deriving a principle if the Supreme Court has already done the historical spade work in a particular case. For example, in Heller, the Supreme Court has already done the text analysis and the historical analog analysis to conclude that in an arms ban case, you cannot ban firearms that are in common use by Americans for lawful purposes. So all these lower courts that decide they want to go off and reinvent the wheel, and they want to, like, you know, invent and come up with new excuses to not justify, let's say, bans on AR-15s, or they want to justify these bans, they pretend that Heller is no longer good law. But my count as of yesterday was the Bruin decision cited favorably the Heller decision over 100 times in the majority opinion. So again, if the Supreme Court has already determined the historical principle, they've already determined the constitutional test, the lower court only needs to apply that test. It doesn't get a second bite of the apple to go out and do more historical work. But let's assume that the Supreme Court has not actually done the work yet, and the lower courts have to do the work now. What is the government lawyer's burden to do once the burden has shifted to them to justify a modern-day gun control law? Well, there's really three basic things. The first is they have to come forward with relevant historical analog laws. Second, they have to derive from those laws some sort of principle. And then they have to apply that principle in some way to justify the modern-day gun control law to show it's justified. And if they fail in any one of these three criteria, the government loses, the right to bear arms prevails, and the gun control law goes bye-bye. So how does one start with finding historical analog laws? Well, there's a number of rules that have been set forth by the Supreme Court, which the court has referred to as metrics. The first metric is, or rule, is this. To have a historical tradition of firearms regulation, you have to start with actual laws, right? And this is, again, you see this, I see this all the time in commentary and among judges. Again, it goes back to, we're not historians, we don't understand history, we don't have a PhD in history, come on. The right answer is the only history that matters is historical laws. Who actually has experience in looking up historical laws and applying them to modern day controversies? Oh, that would be every lawyer in America, right? By definition, lawyers go look in the past, find laws, and apply to your client's advice today or to a case study, whatever it is. The entire practice of law is looking back in time to what happened at the crosswalk on that day, at that time, what is the law that applies. All this is looking into the past. So the suggestion that lawyers cannot do history is simply absurd and an excuse by certain judges to get out to try not to do the work they're tasked to do with the Supreme Court. So again, the first thing is it has to be a law. It cannot be just some generic history or some proposed law that never became an actual regulation. Number two, it has to be from the right time period. Yes, the Supreme Court has made reference to an academic scholarly fight between whether or not the relevant time period for interpreting the Second Amendment is 1791 when the Second Amendment was ratified, or 1868 when the 14th Amendment was ratified, but it's pretty clear the Supreme Court is going to apply the founding era of 1791. To begin with, Heller specifically says so. This is what Heller writes, quote, constitutional rights are enshrined with the scope they were understood to have when the people adopted them. When was the Second Amendment adopted? Not hard, 1791. That is the understanding that controls. And for those of you who question whether or not the Supreme Court will deviate here, I'm just going to direct you to the Supreme Court's decision a few years ago in Espinoza versus Montana, dealing with the religious liberties clauses of the First Amendment, part of the Bill of Rights. And in Espinoza, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, rejected, listen carefully, rejected 30 statewide laws that restricted certain aid provisions, restricted aid to public schools or religious schools. He rejected those as being too late in time in interpreting the First Amendment. If John Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts, is going to reject 30 state laws from the late 19th century as not a basis to limit the scope of the First Amendment, I can assure you they're not going to use late 19th century post-14th Amendment laws to limit the scope of the Second Amendment when push comes to shove. The third rule in terms of whether or not an analog is it cannot be racist or otherwise be founded in something that is unconstitutional. If you look at what the Joe Biden administration's Department of Justice, no friend of guns, no friend of the right to keep and bear arms, they embraced racist laws in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in Rahimi. They get before the U.S. Supreme Court and surprise, surprise, they drop it. They don't argue it. And this, of course, is the right answer, which is exactly what Justice Kavanaugh noted in his concurrence in Rahimi, where he writes that courts must exercise care not to rely on the history that the Constitution has left behind. Racist laws, anti-Catholic laws, all of these things are the sorts of things that cannot serve as an analog in limiting the scope of the Second Amendment right. Now, the fourth rule as to whether or not an analog can be an analog in a Second Amendment case is the analog well established? Is it a representative example, or is it what I would call an outlier? We know based on Supreme Court precedent that laws that are only in existence for a very short period of time, or that did not affect a substantial swath of the American population, do not establish historical traditions. One need only look at what the Bruin Court said, and they say, quote, we will not stake our interpretation of the Second Amendment upon a law in effect in a single state or a single city. Now, the court did not specify the number of quantum of laws, the quantity of laws to justify a tradition, but it did say that three analog laws are not enough. And it's also worth mentioning when you're dealing with territorial laws, those are also a no-go zone for deriving an analog, because as the Supreme Court said in Bruin, the territorial laws are not suitable analogs because they were enacted over a century after the Second Amendment. They only apply to maybe 1% of the population, and they were never subject to judicial scrutiny because they did not have the ACLU fighting for cowboy rights in the Western Territories. So one doesn't actually know if they would have been found constitutional if they were ever challenged in court. Now, that's the first thing. If an analog violates anything I just said, it's a no-go, you can't use it. But let's move on. Let's assume you still have a basket of analogs or proffered analogs by the government that's still in play. You now need to move what I call to the relevantly similar part of the analysis. Relevantly similar gets into, does the why and the how of the analogs you have put together line up with the why and the how modern day gun control laws exist? Now, what does this mean? I think there's a lot of abstract theoretical discussions we could have, but rather than do that, I want to be very precise and ask what the United States Supreme Court has done dealing with these issues, because I think they really do illustrate how you do the why and the how. In Heller, for example, that was a case involving whether or not the District of Columbia's gun ban, handgun ban, was constitutional. After the court in Heller found textually that the Second Amendment protects all bearable arms, and thus DC's law was presumptively unconstitutional, they looked to see if there's a historical analog set of laws at the time of the founding that would justify DC's gun ban. And they found that they could not find any sort of historical tradition. First of all, let's talk about the whys, the whys. DC proffered a law at the time of the founding out of Boston and some other cities that said that you could not have too much quantum or too much of black powder in the home. And DC said, see, there you go. You need powder for firearms. Boston limited the quantum of gunpowder in the homes, and therefore, by extension, we can ban handguns. But obviously, the Supreme Court said that's a no-go. Why? Because the whys, the purposes of the laws do not line up. The black powder storage laws by Boston in the 18th century was about preventing fire from burning down an entire city made of wood, whereas D.C.'s gun ban was about the why or purpose of stopping criminals. And the Supreme Court says the whys don't line up. That doesn't help the government prove its case. But it goes beyond that. There was a set of laws that the Supreme Court found somewhat analogous that could be considered, and that was the laws that said, that regulated what would be considered dangerous and unusual arms. The Supreme Court said there was a tradition at the time of the founding of banning or regulating dangerous and unusual arms. But then the Supreme Court moved on and extended that out and says, as a consequence, because handguns in America are ubiquitous, and are the most preferred means of self-defense of Americans, guess what? They can't be banned because they're in common use by Americans for lawful purposes, and as a consequence, they are not dangerous and unusual. The DC gun ban falls by the wayside, even though the Supreme Court identified a historical set of analogs that justified the banning of dangerous and unusual weapons. But when they applied that principle to the facts of that case, they found that the government, again, could not justify the modern-day gun control law. Now let's turn to Bruin. How did Bruin deal with these historical analogs, with the how and the why? The Bruin court, of course, did something very similar. The big argument that was made by New York to justify their May issue permit regime, which was basically saying if you want to get a handgun to protect yourself in public, you have to go mother may I to licensing officials and say, please, 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 I'm a special person, give me a gun permit to carry guns in public and exercise my right to bear arms, which of course means to carry guns in public. And the Supreme Court struck that down as unconstitutional. And why did they do that? Because there was no historical tradition of banning the carrying in guns at the time of the founding. So New York proffered a set of laws that says that you could ban concealed carry. Listen carefully to this. You could ban concealed carry at the time of the founding in many states. That was the argument by New York. But if you look carefully at that, in every state where you could ban concealed carry, those exact same states always allowed for open carry of firearms. In other words, if you look at the how the right was burdened in Bruin, those laws that prohibited the concealed carry of arms was a burden on the mode by which you carried the gun, not the actual carrying of gun in public for self-defense, because in those states where you could be banned from concealed carrying a gun, you could open carry a gun, effectuating your right to bear arms in public for self-defense, and the Supreme Court thus rejected the New York law in that context because the New York law banned all modes of carry, both open and concealed and distinguish those laws proffered by New York as not adequate, because the how the law was burdened was different from what the how the New York law did versus the how it was burdened by those laws banning concealed carry at the time of the founding. And finally, let's talk about Rahimi. Okay, this is the baseline understanding of Rahimi. Rahimi is the first example of what I call a routine Second Amendment case decided in a routine way. If you think about it, if you're Thomas Kuhn writing about paradigms and scientific revolutions, I would argue that metaphorically, Heller, McDonald, and Bruin were sort of part of a scientific revolution in terms of articulating a Second Amendment framework in an originalist methodology. It really lays out the rules of the road. What makes Rahimi kind of interesting and special is that it's the first example of an ordinary case being decided by virtue of what had prior to that been a scientific revolution in Second Amendment jurisprudence. So what really Rahimi is ordinary science. It's an ordinary people doing ordinary science after the occurrence of a scientific revolution, and that's what Rahimi is really about. It's just an application of all the groundbreaking work the Supreme Court had done in the prior Second Amendment cases. Now, with that said, I think Rahimi is just a basic application of Bruin and Heller, because if you look at it, the how and the why are clearly satisfied. Both the how and the why were satisfied because there were two sets of laws that were so ubiquitous, I think they were referenced in both Blackstone and Hawkins, so we're not talking about any kind of outlaw laws. These were the surety laws, which is a civil law that ahead of time said that if someone is found by a court to be a threat to engage in violence against somebody else, they could be forced to post a bond or get sureties, obviously finding somebody being dangerous. Likewise, the going armed statute said if you use a firearm to go armed and threaten people and terrorize people, you can go to prison, and the Supreme Court said that the why is satisfied by those both historical analog laws, because again, the affray law said if you actually misuse a firearm, and the surety law says if it looks like you're gonna misuse a firearm in a finding by a court, the whys are the same because the why is to stop somebody from misusing firearms going forward into the future, and the hows are very similar because it restricts the ability to possess firearms either because they put you in prison because you violate the going arm laws or they make you post a bond, and if you can't do that, they put you in prison, I believe, under the surety laws. So either way, you're looking at the how and the why are lining up to prevent a, and by the way, the holding of Rahimi is extremely narrow. If you think about it, all Rahimi holds is this. If there's an actual court finding that you are a danger to someone else, you can be temporarily disarmed. Look at all the qualifiers there. There's got to be a finding by a court that you're bad and a danger. It's only temporary disarmament, and that's really all it held. It doesn't get into due process or anything else because Mr. Rahimi admitted that he was a danger, admitted to the entry list, didn't waive his due process rights, so none of those issues were presented in Rahimi, and I'm sure they will be presented in future cases. Now that I've just shown you what violates the rules and cannot be analogs, and then I've also shown you how to deal with the how and the why, which is really another metaphor for deriving the historical principle of a case to apply, I want to get into something that I don't want to call this new because the Supreme Court talked about it, but it's something new today, and that is the five or six approaches to stopping a too high level of generality. One of the concerns that people have posited, including Justice Barrett, is that you can always derive a principle from historical analogs at too high a level to eviscerate the Second Amendment right. For example, every law ever enacted, guess what, is for in the name of public safety and security, right? So, but you can't just say just because a law was enacted for public security, that justifies all modern day gun control laws today. The Supreme Court has repeatedly rejected that. That's exactly what Justice Barrett raised as a potential problem, though. So I'm now gonna posit a series of third rails, guidelines that says that if the principle that you derive from your analog, from your historical analogs and the principles derived from those analogs, if they violate any of what I'm about to say, they're no good, the principle must be rejected because it's too high of a generalized approach. The first is if it violates the directly contrary to the Second Amendment's guarantee of the right of the people to keep and bear arms, it is too high. Judge Kavanaugh discussed this in Heller too when he was on the DC Court of Appeals when he wrote that, quote, post-ratification adoption or acceptance of laws that are inconsistent with the original meaning of the constitutional text obviously cannot overcome or alter that text. So to the extent that you're deriving a principle that will alter the Second Amendment text, that is not allowed, as now Justice Kavanaugh pointed out in Heller 2 on the D.C. Circuit. Number two, The historical principle derived or alleged to be derived by the government cannot violate Supreme Court precedent. So if there is a principle derived by historical analogs today by the government in a case that would violate, let's say, the Heller holding on in common use firearms cannot be banned, that is also a principle that means that the historical principle argued for by the government is too high a level of generality and cannot be accepted. Third, if the derived principle cannot, and this is key, the derived principle alleged by the government cannot come from the perspective of criminal misconduct or the perspective of the criminal. What I mean by this is if you look specifically at Heller, the perspective on Second Amendment rights is how do ordinary law-abiding Americans use firearms? They don't focus on how criminals misuse firearms. We saw that specifically in Heller because Justice Breyer talked all about handguns being used by criminals for criminals for bad purposes. The Supreme Court rejected that mode of analysis and simply said that, hey, all that matters is that Americans value these handguns for self-defense, and that's the perspective. So if the principle derived is all about how criminals misuse firearms, that's a no-go. Likewise, we must keep in mind that the purpose of the Second Amendment, as articulated repeatedly by the Supreme Court, is to protect Americans against all forms of tyranny. All forms of tyranny, and that could be anything from street criminals, could be terrorists, could be animal attacks, as referenced by Justice Kennedy and our argument in Heller. It could also be against repelling foreign invasions, domestic insurrections, and the like. So to the extent that a principle derived by the government violates or eviscerates any of those purposes, that again would be too high a level of generality. And last but not least, I would say that if the proposed principle derived by the government, if applied in 18th century America, would actually turn the American founders into felons, that also is too high of a principle. For example, if you were to buy into the anti-gunner arguments in Bruin, that at the time of the founding, no one was allowed to carry guns, that was verboten, that would mean that every single one of the first six presidents of the United States were felons because every single one of them undeniably carried guns all the time from Washington to Jefferson to Jackson and so on. And if the principle derived in a case by the government would somehow turn every felon, every founder into a felon, if that principle were applied in the 18th century, that again is not allowed. So simply to close the speech as follows. The Second Amendment, it's important to remember in Second Amendment case, the founders had a lived experience with firearms. They were ubiquitous. They had them everywhere they went. They viewed this as part of being a citizen. And they viewed this as such an important right, they literally wrote it in to the Bill of Rights. So I will just sum up by saying that we must never forget the Supreme Court has called the Second Amendment unqualified right. It is always the ultimate history. If there's ever ambiguity or a question about whether or not the government should win, the government should lose because it's actually in the text of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. That should take priority over any airy-fairy history or, you know, attempt to limit those rights by government. Thank you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you today and to share the stage with a titan of the federal judiciary, Judge Thapar. Bill Merkel is always very thoughtful, and thank you for an idea for a 61st case with challenging the Militia Act of 1803. I'll be looking at that this afternoon. And Mark Smith, whose videos are highly, highly informative. I always learn something when I listen to Mark. I agree fully with Mark's description of Bruin and Rahimi's methodology. You start with the text, then you look at the historical record, you derive a historical principle from the how and the why behind those analogs, and then the fourth step that Mark just identified I think is critical and has been missing from pretty much every decision that has messed up below, which is doing a cross-check for guardrails. If you touch a guardrail, you're dead. And if these lower federal judges were to assess their work against those metrics that Mark has just laid out, they would realize the errors of their ways. And I'm going to point out some of the errors of their ways this morning. And I'm going to start with AR-15s. And for those of you who aren't gun people, an AR-15 is a semi-automatic firearm. It is the most popular firearm in America. There are 44 million of them in the United States. They are lightweight. They are accurate. They have no recoil. They shoot bullets that are far less powerful than deer rifles, and they have far less of a blast range than a shotgun. So you might have thought, wow, that's great. Highly accurate, easy to use firearms. That hasn't been the reaction of many left-wing jurisdictions. There are a number of blue states that have rushed in a fit of virtue signaling to ban these. And they've also banned the standard capacity magazines that hold 30 bullets and that are owned, there are about 500 million of them in circulation in the United States today. So how are we to think about these laws? I'd like to start with a radical proposition. Let's look at binding Supreme Court precedent. And binding Supreme Court precedent from Heller teaches and provides a very straightforward test. Firearms that are commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens but for lawful purposes cannot be banned. Full stop, period, let's go have lunch. It's that easy, okay? You don't have to do anything else. And so let's look at AR-15s and see, you know, does that fall within the Heller test? Well, the first question, are they arms? Absolutely. Dr. Johnson, 1775, in his dictionaries, defined an arm as any weapon of offense or defense. So clearly these are arms, and these are arm bans. So then the question is, under the Heller test, are they commonly possessed? Well, we don't have to emanate in the penumbras. These are the most popular firearms in America. So if the test has any meaning whatsoever, it must cover the AR-15. Ditto for the hundreds of millions of magazines that are in circulation today. Are they owned for lawful purposes? Yes. Now, we don't have precise statistics, but if you assume that every firearms homicide committed in the United States of America with a long gun was an AR-15, and they're not, but if you were to assume that, you would conclude that 99.999% of these will never be used in any criminal activity whatsoever. And when we look at surveys and people are asked, why do you own them? They say for self-defense, they say for target shooting, and they say for hunting. And if you think that sounds really straightforward and that the lower courts would just follow this methodology, you would be wrong. Because almost every month we are treated to a new 100-plus page opinion from a court of appeals telling us why that what I've just said is wrong. So where have the lower courts gone astray? Well, some of them say and pretend that these firearms aren't actually arms because they're useful for military service. But that's wrong at every conceivable level. The U.S. military does not use AR-15s. They are semi-automatic. They do not provide suppressive fire. When you pull the trigger once, you get one bullet. And militaries want to have automatic fire capability. They want to have machine guns, and these are not machine guns. Let's look at the guardrails that Mark identified and see if this test in any way violates them. Is it consistent with the text of the Second Amendment? Absolutely not. Check out the prefatory clause, which emphasizes the importance of the militia. Is it consistent with a purpose? Absolutely not. Heller said you want to be able to repel foreign invaders. That requires military proficiency. Is this test consistent with precedent? No, it's not. Heller has a different. Is it consistent with the analogs that Heller identified? No, Heller said in deriving its test that you look at analogs where there's, and you can only ban dangerous and unusual firearms. These are not unusual. Now, the D.C. Circuit has treated us to a different test. They have recently held that arms can be banned when they are capable of unprecedented lethality. Unprecedented lethality compared to the firearms that came before them. And that's wrong too for a number of reasons. Justice Scalia ridiculed as bordering on the frivolous the notion that the Second Amendment only protected arms that existed at the time of the founding. And indeed, the entire history of firearms is the relentless, continual search for more lethality and more accuracy, because these are instruments that determine your life or your death, whether you're going to live free or as a slave, or whether you're going to live as a citizen in your own country or a serf in somebody else's country. And so you bet your bottom dollar that everyone is constantly trying to make these arms more accurate and more lethal. And you say, well, okay, David, but you know, the founders couldn't have envisioned something like an AR-15 that fires 20 bullets at a time. In 1775, someone came to the Continental Congress and said, let me demonstrate my new firearm that fires 20 bullets without reloading. And so not only could they have envisioned it, they actually saw it. Now, the principle of banning firearms with excessive fatality touches upon numerous of the third rails that Mark identified. It's foreclosed by precedent. It's inconsistent with the purpose of the Second Amendment, repelling foreign invaders. It's inconsistent with the how and the why of firearms regulations because they're commonly owned. And it's inconsistent with looking at the regulations from the perspective of law-abiding citizens as opposed through the lens of how criminal might use. You can describe the exact same features as increasing accuracy and the ability to defend oneself or as having excessive lethality in the hands of criminals. Those are two sides of the same coin, and what Heller teaches is we're going to examine firearms regulations from the perspective of law-abiding citizens, not how criminals are going to misuse them. As Mark indicated, the entire defense of the District of Columbia and Heller was, we're allowed to ban handguns because criminals love them. And Justice Scalia said, I don't care. That's irrelevant. They're criminals. They don't follow the law. What we're going to look at is whether law-abiding citizens have a legitimate need. How do we know that? We're going to trust and empower the American people. And if they, in large numbers, have gone out and acquired a firearm for their self-defense, then that's the end of the story. Now, there's a third test that we've been treated to, and that is whether the lower courts have said that Bruin said that they have to be commonly used for self-defense. They said, you know, so unless you can prove that these firearms are used commonly for self-defense, you lose. And there's nothing really inherently wrong with this test, but the flaw is that anti-gun advocates are trying to draw an artificial distinction between possession and use. When you buy an insurance policy, you're using it. When you're driving your car with your airbag, you're using it. And when you buy a gun and you keep it in your house for self-defense, you're using it all the time, even if you don't have to pull it out and shoot someone. How do we know that? Let's check the guardrails quickly. We know it from the text. It talks about keeping, not keeping only if you use. Let's look at, is it inconsistent with a purpose? Of course it is, because one of the purposes was to be able to have a firearm in case of emergency. Is it inconsistent with precedent? Yes, Heller said nothing about this. And Bruin wasn't a rewrite of Heller, as Mark said, it was cited 100 times. Is it inconsistent with historic practice? Yes, it is. There's no indication at the time of the founding. The founders thought, oh, well, we can ban any gun that people aren't using frequently. So the bottom line, here's the bottom line. When you're dealing with a case with a gun ban, Heller governs, and you'll always be able to prove that with a cross-check against the guardrails that Mark has identified. Now let's talk about another topic. Where you can carry a gun. And as you all know, Bruin said 2 years ago, there's an individual right to carry a firearm. But the court also indicated there were certain sensitive places that were off limits to carriage. They listed three places: courthouses, legislatures, and polling places. And so a number of blue jurisdictions have swept in after Bruin and have said, even though we allowed guns in these places previously, now, you know, they're super sensitive. You know, cities are super sensitive, parkland is super sensitive, state parks are super sensitive, you know, basically trying to paint their entire jurisdiction with these sensitive place brush. The Ninth Circuit just decided an important sensitive place case called Wolford versus Lopez. And it involved laws in Hawaii and California that had declared a myriad of places to be sensitive. And after wading through and trying to compare each place with the three places identified in Bruin, the Ninth Circuit declared that guns could be banned in some places like stadiums and museums, but not other places like hospitals and public transportation. And then, interestingly, the Ninth Circuit concluded firearms could be presumptively banned in businesses in Hawaii, but not California. And the Ninth Circuit worried that its opinion was arbitrary, you think? You know, when you're at the point, I wouldn't ever presume to tell a judge how to do their job, but you know, when you're at the point where you're writing, gee, this opinion seems really arbitrary, that might be a time to go back and re-examine. And if they had, one of the flaws for the Ninth Circuit was it did not even attempt to derive a historic principle from the analogs that it has found. And it's little wonder that having failed to actually try to implement the Bruin methodology, it failed spectacularly. Now, the Ninth Circuit isn't alone. The Second Circuit has recently held that vulnerable communities can be treated as gun-free zones. And you're right to ask, how did they derive that principle from the analogs? Were legislatures vulnerable communities? No. Were courthouses vulnerable communities? No. The Second Circuit just made it up, and they didn't engage in the cross checks. They didn't look to see if there's a third rail they were touching. If they had, they wouldn't have been, you know, there wouldn't have been a principle that would have said, you know, let's take people who are vulnerable, strip them of their ability to defend themselves, and paint a target on them. Did the founders do that? No, the founders did the exact opposite of that. At the time of the founding, there were many state laws that said, when you go to church, you must carry a gun. Why? Because everyone was at church, so the community was really vulnerable. That is this vulnerable community test simply doesn't work. Another test that anti-gun advocates are pushing is, well, the common theme in all these places is the exercise of constitutional rights. So whenever constitutional rights are being, if you're in a place where constitutional rights are being exercised, that's a sensitive place. Breathing is a constitutional right. Speaking is a constitutional right. So any place where you're speaking, you're breathing, that can be a sensitive place. Obviously, that's not gonna work. It would eviscerate the Second Amendment. So what are the courts to do? They should look at the history surrounding courthouses, legislatures, and polling places. Now, I know that at least one Supreme Court justice has lamented this would be, quote, exceedingly difficult. But if we talk about 13 colonies in three places, that's 39 maximum statutes divided by four law clerks, it's like less than 10 statutes per law clerk. So I say suck it up and do your job. And, you know, if the courts were to do this, they'd see an interesting theme in these up to 39 statutes. They'd see in virtually every courthouse in America at the time of the founding, there was armed security. And they would see that in virtually every legislature at the time of the founding, there was armed security. And at polling places at the time of the founding, there was armed security. The common theme behind all of these laws is comprehensive security. And it makes sense. When the government provides comprehensive security, there is less of a need for self-defense. So the historic principle is fully consistent with one of the primary purposes of the Second Amendment, self-defense. That's why when you go through TSA and they have metal detectors and armed guards, that you feel less vulnerable on the other side. Now you may say, well, I wore my MAGA hat and was attacked by some Karen. That's an as-applied challenge. That's an as-applied challenge. It's not a facial challenge to TSA. And parks under this would not be sensitive places because you can't secure the egress and ingress. Take a hospital. It could be a sensitive place or not. If the government wants to invest the resources to have every entrance have a metal detector and armed guards, then it's a sensitive place, and if not, not. Now, Heller, I want to say one thing in closing. Heller mentioned schools. Bruin did not. But it is important to know that at the time of the founding, there were lots of restrictions on guns in schools. Harvard in 1655 was the first school to limit guns in schools, and pretty much every college in the country followed suit. But one thing to note, it was only for students. It was never for teachers. There is no historical justification for disarming teachers, and the students could have their Second Amendment rights infringed upon because the schools were in loco parentis. And so they were very differently situated than at least most schools today. I don't think they're in loco parentis. The bottom line is that there is no shortcut for doing the hard historical work. Judges have to look at the statutes. They need to look at the how and the why behind the analogs. And they need to make sure that whatever principle they derive is fully consistent with each of the guardrails that Mark has identified today. And if the principal touches on any of the guardrails, it's dead, and they need to start over and begin again. Justice Scalia really did say it best in Heller. He said, the very enumeration of the right takes it out of the hands of government, even the third branch, the power to decide on a case-by-case basis whether the right is really worth insisting on. Justice Scalia nailed it. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. So we're going to go in order, but Professor Merkel, would you like to go first, then Professor Smith, then Mr. Thompson, responding to each other and the comments that were made?
Sure. Whether I agree with the last statement depends very much on what the meaning of it is. Justice Scalia said it best. And you quoted him directly. But I take the gist of Justice Scalia's pronouncements in Heller to be rather different. In order to decide whether a restraint on gun rights is permissible today, we start with the text of the Constitution, the relevant text being the Second Amendment. And except, of course, that 48% of the relevant constitutional text has no meaning whatsoever, because Justice Scalia says so in 2008, 217 years after the relevant text was ratified. We then turn to the purpose of any gun control measure today and ask whether that purpose is consistent with the purpose of the Second Amendment, having, of course, accepted Justice Scalia's proposition in 2008 that the purpose clause of the Second Amendment has no meaning whatsoever. Pure ipsy dixit, if you look at Heller, at the point at which Justice Scalia labels the first 48% of the Second Amendment inoperative, he cites no authority whatsoever. He simply states that it's well known that the prefatory clause is without significance and the operative provision is of great significance. No footnote, no authority. Now, where does this leave us when it comes to gun control? I strongly suspect that my alternative vision of earthly paradise isn't necessarily terribly different from yours. I would quite happily live in a regime in which guns were as ubiquitous and precisely as well regulated as motor vehicles. That wouldn't trouble me over much. You have the right to self-defense, whether that right to self-defense is best justified through warping the original understanding of the Second Amendment or through frank acknowledgement that unwritten constitutional rights, including a right to personal self-defense, may be judicially enforced under the Constitution, is perhaps just a question of taste. I'll say one final thing. My late co-author, Professor Richard Uviller, who for many years in the 1960s represented the New York County District Attorney's Office in appellate cases before the Supreme Court, many of which he lost, arguing that the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments should not be as generously construed in favor of criminal defendants as they have become, made one point to me about metaphors, policing your metaphors. Now, I don't mean to appear smug, but a third rail and a guardrail are not at all the same thing, right? The guardrail keeps you safe. It keeps you from going off the track. The third rail is electrified. You step on the third rail, and unless you are very fortunate the power's off, or you're wearing very thick rubber boots, I suppose it's the end of the line. But I think in the end, all of us could coexist in a safe society with gun ownership very common, gun ownership regulated. Whether you wish to tolerate regulations is a policy question, and one that the Second Amendment focused on arms bearing in the lawful militia, as made quite clear by the first 13 words that Justice Scalia says have no legal effect. Well, the Second Amendment does a lot of work today, but it does that work because of judicial fiat, not because of original public understanding of the text.
Professor Smith.
is this on? Six quick observations. Number one is another justification for the comprehensive security as the principle about when government mandated gun-free zones are constitutional is the basic law, which has been recognized all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, is the government and police has no legal duty to protect any of us from criminals unless we are in their custody. So I think the metaphor, metaphors works quite well, that if the government is willing to step up and provide comprehensive security and essentially take us within their warm embrace arms and protect us with their own guns, then perhaps our right to self-defense can go away in that context. But unless they're willing to waive their right to be ensued, they can't have it both ways. They can't say, we have no duty to protect you from criminal activity, but we're going to ban you from having the right to self-defense in that location without actually protecting me and taking on the responsibility to protect me. It cannot work, which is why I think another reason, in addition to what David said, that comprehensive security makes sense as a principle. Number two, Professor Merkel, who's always articulate, and I appreciate you coming here. You always do a great job, and I learn something from you all the time.
Likewise.
He made a reference to something that this notion in Rahimi that law is not set in amber, but that should not be taken as necessarily helpful to anti-gun proponents or gun control proponents, because the law set in amber can actually work in favor of freedom. Give you an example. It's arguable that at the time of the founding, it's arguable that handguns were sufficiently rare that perhaps theoretically, you could have banned handguns in the 18th century, maybe, but let's assume you could do that. But you certainly cannot ban guns today because because they're ubiquitous. And that's an example where law, not made in amber, not as set in amber, actually expands freedom in that sense. Something you could have done in the 18th century, you can't do today because handguns might have been dangerous and unusual then, but they're not today, and that's an example of law not being in amber, actually favoring freedom. The third thing is it's true, English laws have no real bearing on American law, but what the statute in Northampton, just so you understand, that comes up because there are several states that adopted a version of the statute in Northampton, so really the Supreme Court is looking at American analogs of the statute of Northampton in talking about its role. Now, I also want to debunk a myth that the militia clause has been written out of history by the Supreme Court. That's absolutely not true. The militia clause was integral with the Supreme Court decision in Heller because the in common use test derived from a proposition that says that ordinary Americans at the time of the founding would bring their typically possessed firearms with them to militia duty, and therefore today, Americans are able to bring their commonly owned firearms or typically owned firearms today with them metaphorically to militia duty now, and therefore you cannot ban firearms that are in common use today because those are the same sorts of arms you would bring to militia duty in the 18th century. So the militia concept actually was integral to the Heller decision. And likewise, if you look at the 1930s decision in United States versus Miller, if you look at the holding there, they specifically said that the problem there and why they upheld the National Firearms Act in the Miller case was because there was no evidence that the sawed-off shotgun was something that connected to the militia. If the Supreme Court in the 1930s simply wanted to say that there is no right to keep and bear arms if you're not connected to the militia. All the court had to say in Miller was, hey, Frank Miller is not a member of the militia, therefore he has no right. They didn't have to take it to the next level and talk about the arm that he was in possession of, showing that Miller actually shows their individual right to keep and bear arms by virtue of the holding of the case itself. And last but not least, with respect to cars, just as a passing side note, one might actually embrace the notion that firearms should be regulated like automobiles, because I can have as many automobiles as I want, unregistered, with no insurance in my backyard, on my property, no harm, no foul, and if I want to take it out in public, well, there's a license, and that license, by the way, for my driver's license is good in all 50 states and territories and across the world. So I might actually take that deal conceptually, embrace the notion of driver's licenses as a metaphor for carrying and owning guns in America. We can have that debate.
Yes, many thanks both to the professor and to Mark for their very thoughtful and helpful comments. Just four quick points. Number one, there was a little bit of a flavor, I think, in the professor's remarks, certainly in briefs that I get from the other side, the notion that the greater includes the lesser, that if we can imprison you or put you to death for something, then surely we can take your gun away. And, you know, so we look back at some of the founding era laws that were death penalty laws. There was one for blasphemy, denying the existence of the Trinity. That was a death penalty offense. So sort of under this analysis, it would be like, okay, every atheist can be disarmed because we could have killed them at the time of the founding, and therefore they have no say. I don't think that's gonna get five votes on the court. So, you know, and it's also, what it's doing is it's picking up on something that Chief Justice Roberts said, but he was much more careful and much more precise and much more accurate, which he focused on, if the crime that you're being punished for, that we could put you in prison for, is related to misuse of a firearm, then the greater includes the lesser. He said on page 14 of Rahimi, the going armed laws provided for imprisonment, and if imprisonment was permissible to respond to the use of guns to threaten the physical safety of others, that's that misuse of the gun, then the lesser restriction of temporary disarmament of the section is permissible. So that was point one. Point two, I do agree with Mark that I don't think it's fair to say that Justice Scalia read the prefatory clause out of the Second Amendment. He said, quote, logic demands that there be a link between the stated purpose and the command. And so he identified a number of purposes. One of them was serving, having a well-regulated militia. There was also self-defense, repelling foreign invaders, fighting domestic tyranny, hunting. So it wasn't the only one, but the idea that it does no work, and you could hear today, we had a number of times where we were referencing that purpose that comes from the text of the amendment. There was a brief reference, I think, by the professor, sub silentio, to corpus linguistics, the idea that 95% of the time the word bear was used during war, it had a military connotation. You know, I think if you were to look at the number of times the word aircraft was used from 1940 to 1945, you know, you would probably conclude, like, civilian airlines, that's not really a thing, you know. People seem pretty focused on, you know, the military dimensions of the airplanes. So corpus linguistics, Mark has done an awesome article on that. Check it out. It puts that to rest. And then the final thing was there was the invocation of the Sullivan Law as a defense of New York's as being 100 years old. But, you know, these laws are supposed to illuminate the original public meaning of the Second Amendment. And something that took place in the 20th century tells us precisely nothing about what Madison and Hamilton and the other founders thought. So those were my four quick points.
Thank you. We will take questions. They have to have a question mark at the end, and I'll cut you off after 20 seconds because we only have 10 minutes left. While they're getting up to ask questions, do any of you want a final word?
I'll just stress that I don't necessarily disagree with anything that Mark or David said, except about the relegation of the purpose clause of the Second Amendment to relative insignificance in Justice Scalia's opinion in Heller.
Okay. We'll go over there first. You get 30 seconds or less for your question.
I'll be quick. My name is Benjamin Pugh. I'm from the Orange County chapter of the People's Republic of California, where we definitely have a gun grabber as a governor. The issue that I don't think we talked about too much today were possible red flag laws and depriving citizens of their right to bear arms. Anyone who practices anywhere near family law knows it's super easy to get a domestic violence restraining order. There's hardly any process. You write a declaration.
Okay, question.
And they're gone.
30 seconds is up.
So,
red flag laws.
Red flag laws. What burden of proof?
Welcome to America, first of all, Ben.
Thanks.
Look, red flag laws are BS, because all red flag laws are is an excuse to end run around long-standing, decades-long laws that have existed that apply to people that have demonstrated that they are dangerous to themselves or to others in the form of civil commitment laws. Civil commitment laws have literally been around since at least the 1960s and actually going back to the founding. And the reason why people, the anti-gunners, like red flag laws from a PR point of view is because they know that there's been a very well-developed body of due process and protections in the context of civil commitment, where you get your own lawyers, you get experts, you get all sorts of protections, and the standard is clear and convincing evidence. The anti-gunners hate all the due process that comes with civil commitment laws, so they want to create a new system of justice designed only for gun owners. Because if you don't have a gun, red flag laws don't apply to you, but the civil commitment laws do, and that's what they bury. They're burying the lead. They don't want civil commitment laws because it's not about public safety. It's about the guns and disarming you, so you are no longer a citizen. You become a serf. That's what red flags are about, and what we're really talking about is civil commitment laws, and that is what should be applied if someone is a danger to themselves or to others.
Any other responses before I go to the next question?
Well, agreed that civil commitment focuses on due process. Justice Thomas's dissenting opinion in Rahimi, I think, takes many nods in the direction of the due process questions not joined by the Rahimi court. So, you know, I would only qualify Mark's remarks by stressing that your question may not be a Second Amendment question, or at least not a Second Amendment question standing alone so much as a due process question. And even the due process that has been developed in the civil commitment arena is nothing like the due process under the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendments required in the criminal law context. So, you know, again, we're talking about temporary deprivation, your pending criminal adjudication, I think.
Over here, 30 seconds.
Adam Doverspike, Tulsa Lawyers Chapter. Be interested to hear the panel's view after Rahimi on federal felon dispossession laws, 922, and if it matters whether the precedent felony was a violent felony or not, and how that's going to play out.
Well, there's a lot of litigation about that. The Third Circuit has an en banc case called Range, which they issued. Then they got GVR'd, and they've gone back, and it's been re-argued. So I do think that's an issue that is likely to make it to the Supreme Court. Now, I don't know whether Solicitor General John Sauer, my former colleague, will seek cert, but certainly Preligar would have sought cert, I think, on that. And there's just really no historical precedent for disarming people who were not a danger to themselves or others. And, you know, Mr. Range is alleged to have committed fraud on food stamps to feed his family once 40 years ago and has been a law-abiding citizen. And the government can't even bring themselves to say that he's a danger to himself or others. And so I just don't think there's any tradition for that. So a faithful application of Bruin and Rahimi would lead to at least as-applied challenges in those contexts.
I think what's implicated is a reconsideration of Justice Scalia's dicta in Heller, as echoed by Justice Alito writing for the court in McDonald, that there are areas or contexts in which Second Amendment rights are either not fully applicable or perhaps, you know, entirely inapplicable. The sensitive places, the convicted felons, these carve-outs, all dicta in Heller and McDonald, the extent to which the carve-outs endure, or you know, to borrow a concept from Canadian constitutional law, become invitations to carve-outs on analogous grounds, that remains to be seen.
Thank you.
Professor Smith, anything before I, nope, over here.
Kai Alberg from the People's Republic of Washington, which bans AR-15s, any other gun that looks scary, and large magazines. What do you see the route and possible timing of making states like that abide by Heller and Bruen and have these laws struck down that are blatantly unconstitutional under current law?
Well, the United States Supreme Court's going to have to take one of those cases. And one of the challenges that we have is the fact that they're all coming out of very blue states, which tend to have blue circuits. And so there isn't a split yet in that. You know, in the carriage context, there we had suits in the first, second, third, fourth circuits, all of which we lost on the very same issue as Bruen. And it was cert denied, cert denied, cert denied. There was no split. And then we got a great panel in the D.C. Circuit. And then, for whatever reason, the members of the D.C. Circuit decided they didn't really want to vote en banc and go on the record as what they thought about the Second Amendment. So there was a split there. Now, D.C. decided not to file a cert petition, so we immediately refiled in the first, second, third, and fourth circuits a new suit saying, please rule against us quickly because we're going to file a cert petition in this case. And that's what actually made it up to the Supreme Court. So look, I mean, they should take one of the cases. They've got a petition for me right now. They're going to be examining in the next month. I think it should be compelling. The lower courts are just, this is massive resistance akin to what happened after Brown versus Board of Education. So the court should absolutely take one of these cases this term. But whether they're going to, a lot of times they wait for a split, so we'll just have to, you know, we'll know in a month.
Thank you. I just want to add that I think the new Office of Civil Rights under President Trump should laser focus on vindicating Second Amendment rights among the states. That has not been done yet, but there's no reason not to.
Paul Krause from Oakland, California. Professor Merkel, what meaning would you give to the militia clause, and how would that meaning be consistent with not infringing the right to keep and bear arms?
Well, the right to keep and bear arms, as I read it, and this was the dominant reading in the late 18th century, is a right to render military service in the context of the lawfully established militia. This was the dominant reading up until Heller. That doesn't mean I wouldn't, if I were a judge making law, you'll perish the thought that judges make law, but let's assume in some alternative constitutional universe that featured constitutional text identical to our own, I became a judge making law from the bench. As said, I would recognize a right to self-defense under the Ninth Amendment, under substantive due process, under procedural due process, in the sense that someone prosecuted for using weapons to defend themselves would, in my view, be deprived not only of this substantive right, but the conviction, any conviction for a criminal offense that was premised on the use of force for self-defense, in my view, would also violate procedural due process. So we'd be talking about a constitutional right, much like your sexual liberties, much like the right to marry, that might draw some life from the various constitutional provisions, might even float in you know, Justice Douglas's jurisprudence in the penumbra of specific provisions of the Bill of Rights, including the Second Amendment. That would make the right a real one, but I would not pretend that its mailing address is in the text proclaiming a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Last question, I'm sorry to everyone else.
Anna Bergstrom, former Oregonian resident, now within the Freedom of North Dakota. I would like to know, I have a rather absurd hypothetical, but not that absurd in light of Oregon's history. I would like to know your thoughts on when our historical right to bear arms could give way as surveillance technology increases sensitive spaces, even within private spaces. As Mr. Thompson, you had mentioned that these same sensitive spaces such as museums and such are coming forth. So, for instance, what would you say if the United States-
You got about 5 seconds.
I got it right here, Judge Thapar. If the United States increases public surveillance at every park and creates those sensitive spaces, At what point do we say, government, you have increased too much and such that we don't
I think that is an interesting point, you can't declare a whole city, like you can't create a totalitarian, dystopian space and say, we provide security, no guns. You know, like that doesn't work. But, and because I would say a further caveat is it has to be a place like a courthouse where you go for a very short period of time, infrequently, and fine. Then they can say, we're going to provide the security to you. You know, how often as a member of the public do you vote? Every two, every 4 years? How long does it take? 5 minutes? Okay, we can, we can strip you of your right because we're going to provide you comprehensive security. But if it's, you know, something like here's a town, you know, or a, you know, place where you're going to have to spend a lot of time, it just won't work, even if they provided comprehensive security. That would be my answer.
When seconds count, police are minutes away, and surveillance has nothing to do with security. Surveillance is what police officers do, which is to show up after you're dead and draw a chalk line around your body. That does not advance the right to self-defense or the right to keep and bear arms. So having a bunch of cameras, like CCT cameras all over London, certainly doesn't stop anyone from getting stabbed, right? It doesn't. So yeah, no, surveillance cameras has no meaning in terms of comprehensive security because it doesn't actually substitute for being able to defend yourself against people that want to do harm to you violently and physically.
I wonder if, I'm sorry, Judge.
No, you can go.
I wonder if there may not be the possibility of a trend developing in the other direction as we embark upon an experiment in deregulation and libertarianism. Government spaces presumably will shrink, and those government spaces are, in the dicta of Heller, carve-outs, sensitive places where the Second Amendment right does not attach. Well, if we have fewer government spaces because half of federal agencies disappear in the next year, there would be less government.
There you go.
Space.
You got a round of applause for that one. I want to thank the Federal Society and, more importantly, our amazing panel. You guys were fantastic, and I can't thank you enough
thank
for
you.
Doing this. So, and remember, the Bork Lecture, International Ballroom, Reception Terrace level, none of you will forget now. Thank you all for coming. Thanks for the great questions.
Always a pleasure, Mark.